This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at a new airline from the founder of JetBlue, a proposed change to flight training regulations for experimental light sport aircraft, the devastation to Tyndall Air Force Base as a result of Hurricane Michael, Bombardier's lawsuit against Mitsubishi, a helicopter passenger saves the day when the pilot passes out, and the Lion Air fatal accident. We also have interviews from the Great Pacific Air Show at Huntington Beach, California, and the EAA Chapter 141 Stick and Rudder Fall Fly-In and Poker Run. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 525 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Max, how are you?
Max, I'm excellent. Happy to be at home. Been doing a lot of traveling this month and happy to catch up with you here today.
You have been a busy boy. We'll talk about some of your aviation adventures, I think, a little bit later. But first, let's introduce our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hi. Well, hello, everyone. How's everything? Things are quiet on my end, but I have a little bit of a public service announcement later on. But looking forward to being back recording.
Yes, absolutely. First off, let me just take a moment to express my sincere thanks to all of you who sent your condolences on the passing of my wife, Lisa. I received messages on email, it came in on Twitter, Facebook, from our Slack team, texts and cards, and it was all a bit overwhelming, but at the same time, it touched me deeply, and well, it really made a difference, so thank you for that. We took a couple of weeks off, but we're now back, but starting a little bit slowly. We'll wait a couple of weeks before we re-engage the guests we had lined up. I think I need a little more time to keep doing all the things you have to do when this happens. But meantime, I need to get back into the routine that comes with podcasting. So let's get to it. We'll start with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first item comes from Skift. JetBlue founder reveals details on his new tech-focused international airline. Now, we previously talked about JetBlue founder David Neeleman creating a new airline, and here's some of the things that we know. It probably won't be named Moxie. I guess that's going to remain the code name, probably not the final airplane or airline name. Also, Brazil's Azul will feed traffic to the new airline. Of course, Neeleman founded that airline. He's also chairman of that. They're going to fly from Florida to northern Brazil destinations. And in fact, they say they're going to fly hundreds of routes, probably most without any nonstop competition. All of this, of course, is with the Airbus A220-300, formerly known as the C Series. Neeleman says that aircraft has the capability of taking off from really short runways. It can fly for 11 hours. He says the maintenance and other costs are lower on that airplane than some of the older generation narrow bodies. It's got lower fuel burn, longer range. And he really sees that as kind of a, I think, as sort of a key aspect of this new airline. So, it's always fun when someone starts a new airline. You never know where it's going to go, but there's sort of some interesting features of this one. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's really interesting that he feels that they're going to city pairs that aren't currently being flown to. I mean, that really kind of struck me as unusual. But then the fact that he's using the C-Series, I guess, allows him to, reach smaller cities with smaller loads, since that's not a huge aircraft, and yet still has tremendous range. You know, some of the cities he mentioned, for example, Scranton, Pennsylvania, which wasn't terribly far from where I grew up, and it's like, wow, that's not your classic, destination to fly into, only because, it's a city of about 100,000 people, so it's not huge. There were some.
Come on, Dunder Mifflin's there. Everybody wants to see that.
Oh, well, could. Yeah, okay. Sounds good to me. There are some interesting aspects of it. I mean, the one that really struck me the most was that he said that customers would not be able to initiate a phone call to the airlines. He said, you don't have to speak to us. You won't be able to speak to us. You'll be able to reach out to us, and we'll be able to chat with you, and we'll call you. And I'm like, wow, that's... That's pretty unusual. But, that those kinds of technologies are being used for other companies, so I suppose it could work. I think we're just used to a little bit more hand-holding when it comes to, buying airline tickets and dealing with travel issues.
Yeah, he did talk about this new app that will come that will really be the basis for the, as you say, the interaction between the flyer and the airline. And, in some ways, that's kind of consistent with the way a lot of people like to operate. I mean, more and more people, it seems to me, don't pick up the phone and call a company or some provider of services, even though it may be faster, a more efficient way of communication. Instead, people seem to prefer texting and, chatting and typing at each other. So I can also imagine that being a way that they can reduce costs here, without having a presence. You won't even be able to check in at the airport, apparently, without this app. You walk in, you check in, with the app. So I can envision there being fewer employees in this airline if so much of the transaction that you encounter with the airline is taking place on this app.
Yeah, until something happens.
Yeah. Well, I guess the agents on the other side of the app have the ability to contact you, to call you if that becomes necessary. But I suppose they'll try to set this up so that doesn't have to happen too often. But it will have to happen sometimes, I would think.
And I'm wondering if maybe this is going to be more attractive to younger customers, when you talk about texting and dealing with apps and mobile check-in. I'm kind of thinking of the, 35 or 40 and younger kind of crowd. Now, granted, folks older than that are able to do that. But I'm just wondering if they're going to have a kind of skew toward a younger demographic than some of the other airlines.
Now,
it's Uber. It's an Uber airline.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, right.
I mean, it's an Uber model. And I don't know if the airline industry will ever be able to follow that kind of model.
Yeah, you don't think people are ready for that?
Well...
Or is the industry not ready for that?
I don't think that... My problem with app-driven... businesses is they do really well when things are going well, but when things go wrong, they're a terrible issue. What's the worst thing that you can happen with an Uber driver? Leaving out things like sexual assault or anything, but really the worst thing that'll happen is they don't show up for whatever reason.
Right.
Okay. What's the solution? You get another car to them.
Yeah. What's the equivalent here, right? There is none, really.
Okay. You've got a major weather event like a hurricane in Florida. You've got all of these people who are supposed to go through the Caribbean to Brazil. They cancel one flight. You need to rebook on another flight. Now, how do you communicate that to the people on the app? How does the app handle the volume that's going to quintuple? Because not only are you having to try to find flights for the people that are on the booked flights, but what happens if you need to book them on a flight, say, with another airline? How does that work?
Yeah, that may not work at all.
Does the airline just throw up his hands and say, oh, well, sorry, we can't do it on the app. Here's your money back. Go find yourself another flight. Or you keep a minimum amount of staff on to support the normal day-to-day customer service issues. How do you expand or throttle the capacity based on circumstances beyond people's controls, which aviation's loaded with it? You know, it's not, I don't know. I just am a little cynical about this kind of model for an airline. Now, it could be the best customer service ever. It will probably make United look like they're a complete idiots. Oh, wait a minute. They already are. I'm sorry. But that
you couldn't
being
resist,
said,
could you?
I couldn't. But that being said, United has got people on the phone, and unfortunately, I know what it's like to be on the other end of the phone when someone's yelling at you. I have all the empathy in the world for those people who take those calls. But an app, or more to the point, let's go something simpler than flights. What happens if the app goes down?
Yeah, there's no. What's the backup plan? What's the alternative? Doesn't seem like there is one. But
yeah, checking in 100 people when you can't do it on the phone could suddenly get difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I don't know. Maybe I'm just being overly cynical and they're thinking about these things, but it just seems like it's not necessarily the best model to be following.
Well, we'll see. If it goes according to plan, we'll see kind of soon, because they expect this airline to start flying in 2021. So there's not a lot of time between now and then. I don't know what's harder to bring on the aircraft or get the app developed. I'm not sure which of those two is more difficult, but I don't know. I think, you know, other than that issue, I think, which is not insignificant, but David, but I think other than that, you know, I think it's got a lot going for it. I think the Bombardier planes will, you know, fit this role, fit these kinds of missions, fit this kind of cost structure really, really well. But 2021 is going to come up pretty quick.
There's one other aspect we haven't talked about, and that is that the founder also owns Azul Airlines down in Brazil.
Yeah.
And he says that you know, they'll be able to feed him traffic, and they'll do all kinds of things for his new airline that, you know, they won't do for other companies, since he controls that company as well. So that's kind of an interesting combination that might make him stronger in the South American, you know, the kind of North-South America's travel.
Yeah, for sure. And he is planning on flying not only to South America, but from the United States to Europe as well. This is pretty expansive plans, I think. But I can't wait to see how this one works out.
Yeah, and I hadn't realized this, the A220, 11-hour range. That's incredibly long. You know, you think of, its bigger brothers, you know, A320 and stuff like that. I don't think those will fly for 11 hours, so it's pretty amazing.
I don't know if I want to be in a C-Series for 11 hours. I mean, it's bad enough flying to Singapore and whatever that ridiculous thing is at 18 hours, but I don't think there's going to be any business class or first class seats in this thing. So 11 hours in the C-Series, not sure I'd want to spend 11 hours in a narrow body.
I think he is planning multiple cabins. He is planning a first class, a lie flat business class, according to this article, and extra legroom seats in coach. But I think they're maybe away from sort of settling on the configurations of the planes. And it may be different for the different missions. I don't know. I don't know if he's going to make the layout common across the entire fleet. But it's interesting. I don't know. If anybody can pull this off, I think he's got a good shot at it, personally.
Yeah, I agree. I think JetBlue is a very successful airline. And if he could replicate anywhere close to that kind of success, he'll do well.
All right, well, moving on, AvWeb reports new experimental aircraft flight training policy proposed. And this is something that would be under a letter of deviation authority, an LODA. Max, do you call that a LODA?
No, I don't call that. But this is something that's been an issue in experimental aircraft for a long time. Certainly, I'm a flight instructor, and I run into people who want to get trained in experimental aircraft, and there is not a way to rent them. I guess you can hire instructors in your own personal aircraft. But there's just been a number of limitations. I think what this really will do will kind of open up the rental market for light sport aircraft that are, designated experimental. And I don't know that this is going to help out on some of the larger aircraft that are experimental that people might want to be able to rent and get flight instruction in. But certainly it's a start, which is good.
So let me try to understand this because I was kind of confused. So currently you cannot... Is this correct? You cannot charge someone for flight instruction for what, an experimental or a light sport aircraft or both?
Well, let's see. So there are different kinds of light sport aircraft. The ones that are certificated, for sure, those can be rented, and you can buy flight instruction in them and so on. I think we're talking here about experimental LSA, and I have to admit I don't know the differences between that and the certificated ones. But for sure, for those in the past, you haven't been able to, make them available for rent. And so you wouldn't be able to get flight instruction in those unless it was a personal one that you owned. And then I think you can have an instructor, teach you in it. I'm not familiar with all the nuances. I just know that it's not as clean a picture as it is with certificate aircraft like, Cessnas, Pipers, Cirruses.
So that's interesting. So it is a way to look at it that, we have this category of aircraft, light sport aircraft, but also experimental. So, I think we're talking about amateur built aircraft. And so by regulation, you can't rent them. And because you can't rent them, you can't get instruction in one unless it's yours.
I think that's correct. And that's been a real problem for people who are building, airplanes that would get trained to fly them before there's, is finished. I think that there may be ways that the industry has, tried to work around it, but I don't think it's been real clean.
So, of course, the EAA is very excited about this. In fact, the EAA government relations director says that, quote, "The successful publication of this rule and the accompanying policy change will create new opportunities in ultralight and sport pilot training. We see ultralights and light sport aircraft as an increasingly important pathway into aviation, and we are working with the FAA in a variety of ways to remove unnecessary barriers to access. This is one small but important step in that overall process." So, I guess the promise of this is good. I hope it has the effect that they're anticipating. All right, this is from asia.nikkei.com. Mitsubishi Jet faces another delay with Bombardier lawsuit. Well, I didn't see this coming. Of course, the Mitsubishi Regional Jet, the MRJ, has encountered lots of setbacks over the years. It's been delayed and delayed and delayed. Well, now Bombardier has filed a lawsuit that alleges that Mitsubishi Aircraft received trade secrets from former Bombardier employees. So these former employees now work for Mitsubishi. When they were at Bombardier, they worked on the C-Series jet. And according to the lawsuit, these employees allegedly sent C-Series data to their personal email accounts before leaving Bombardier and then walked into Mitsubishi aircraft with that. Of course, Mitsubishi aircraft says that these allegations are without merit. That's their quote. And that we see these proceedings as a recognition of our competitive product, and this lawsuit primarily as an attempt by Bombardier to stifle global competition. Wow. I don't know. I didn't see this one coming.
No, but you know what? I think that this is the old case of if there's smoke, there may be fire. If indeed this was sent from the the company email address as well. It's pretty, you know, there's going to be a pretty transparent record, I think, of what happened in this particular case. And it, to me, this is just reminiscent of what we see often in the tech industry, where Google is hiring someone from Apple or vice versa from Microsoft. And even with some of the flying car companies and Uber and things like that, it's very easy, I think, for sometimes employees to make a misstep if they bring along some data, or if someone thinks they brought along some data. And these companies are quick to sue, because, you know, losing trade secrets can be, you know, worth countless millions of dollars. So,
sure.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that the situation, one, happened, and two, it's being, you know, litigated.
Usually companies try to put controls in place to prevent this from happening. Usually when you work at a company like Bombardier or an aerospace company, you have a, you know, an employment contract or conditions of employment or something that usually specifically addresses this issue of taking company data outside of the company. My experience has been when it becomes known to the company that someone is going to be leaving, that usually that results in them leaving that day, right? You do not go back to your desk. You walk out to the, you know, you're escorted out to the front lobby and out the door, and someone will pack up your personal belongings and let you know when you can come pick up the box. It sounds kind of draconian, but companies, you know, like to protect themselves from employees. Because if that's what happened, if Bombardier employees walked away with proprietary data and gave it to Mitsubishi, Bombardier is going to be... Well, they'll both be in hot water. Mitsubishi will be in hot water for, you know, utilizing this data. But Bombardier is, you know, not without fault in this if they allowed it to happen. At least that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I think you outlined it exactly the way I saw it from the years I spent working in high tech. And I think sometimes when these things happen, it's not necessarily the companies that are at fault. It's, some ambitious employees who figure, hey, I can be the fair-haired golden child in my next job if I bring along the goods. And, you know, it may not be the other company on the receiving end that had anything to do with it. But yeah, I've actually seen, you know, companies that have received things just immediately send it back, full disclosure. It's like, hey, we don't want this.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And I think that's really the ethical thing to do in these situations, is just make full disclosure immediately, send that stuff back and say, hey, we're sorry this happened. It was not our intent, and we want to let you know we're trying to make this right.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen instances where a customer will provide information about one of your competitors unasked for, you know, just handed to you. And, you need to know when that's proprietary information for a competitor. And the answer is not, oh, you take it back with you to the hotel room, you know, and after the meetings and pore over it. You have to return that stuff right away and, you know, visibly and in some way that is documented. So you really need to, you need to have a sense of ethics for these kinds of things.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's the overriding word. And I don't know if the company cultures are going to be different in Japan versus for Canada. I just don't know. But for sure here in the U.S., that would be, you know, treated as a, you know, pretty strong breach that needed to be addressed.
Yep, yep. All right, well, let's talk a little bit of military aviation. And we heard from a listener. This was concerning the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, which sort of blasted Florida and a few other southern states. He writes, I wonder why the U.S. Air Force hasn't built more hardened hurricane-proof hangars in areas prone to recurring hurricanes. The cost associated with the damage to the hangar queens at Elgin would cover a few hundred hardened hangars. And there's an article in The Drive. This is, we finally know how many F-22s were left behind at Tyndall Air Force Base during Hurricane Michael. David, what happened? There was... some damage, I guess, to the base, maybe a lot of damage, and some of the planes were there, some were not there. What does this look like?
Oh, this topic has burdened me since the hurricane hit. Michael was kind of a special event. It was on Monday, a tropical storm, and by when it hit land, only a couple days later, it was a Category 4 hurricane. People have no idea what it's like to force a major squadron or of aircraft out of an emergency evacuation. I can say that because I know what was involved, because it happened to my father's squadrons a couple of times. When you have a squadron of 24 aircraft, not all of them are flyable at one time. You have hangars. Now, this listener wants to know why the Tyndall hangars weren't reinforced concrete. I don't think reinforced concrete would have handled the storm that hit Tyndall. It basically leveled the airfield. If you go back to when Hurricane Andrew hit, we completely lost a whole base there too. No strength of buildings can cover the magnitude of the hurricane that hit Tyndall this year. So a couple of things. One is, from a civil engineering point, you just don't put up a concrete hangar. You just don't do that. The multi-million dollars that it costs to put up a hangar, you have to tear down a hangar if you're replacing it. Yes, it's going to protect a couple of airplanes, but over time, it's still a huge investment in money, manpower, and effort. Yes, the F-22 is the most valuable aircraft that we have in the U.S. Air Force inventory. We don't have a lot of them. That could be argued that, well, we should have bought more. That being said, I personally do not ever want one life jeopardized for saving a goddamn aircraft from a hurricane. There were far more important things to do than battening down the hatches for the aircraft that couldn't fly out.
So you're talking about evacuating the personnel?
Evacuate the personnel. You can evacuate the aircraft, but in this case, we didn't have a lot of time. But there's always going to be aircraft in the hangars with engines pulled. You're not going to drop everything to put another engine in to save the airplane. There were families on that base. There were military personnel who needed to get out of there in time. If you've got a week, yeah, you send the aircraft inland. You got 48 hours, you get the hell out of there and we'll deal with fixing airplanes later. Well, why didn't we save the airplanes? Because our military's better than that. We save lives. And that base is toast. They're just starting to come back.
The planes that they flew out, where they flew them to Wright-Patterson?
Yes. Each coastal base has a relief base. When we had the hurricane 2 weeks before, the name escapes me, it hit North Carolina.
Florence, I believe.
Florence. All of those Marine Corps stations, Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina, Seymour Johnson in North Carolina, they all have evacuation bases, which are mainly inland. You know, we have been an evacuation base at Willow Grove for the Navy at Oceana. And we've also evac'd from Willow Grove out farther west to Ohio, et cetera, to get the planes safe. But no aircraft is ever worth the loss of life. And this base will get rebuilt. It will cost lots of money, but it's still a matter of lives. The last comment was, is there a cover-up going on? They had plenty of time to act. No, they didn't. The Air Force did everything they could to evacuate the important people, the wives, the sons, the daughters, right? Mm-hmm. The bare minimum people stayed at Tyndall. Yeah, there were aircraft. I saw the drone footage of the QF-16s in the hangar, and the hangar is completely devastated. And all of that will get rebuilt. But I don't think Tyndall lost a single life from that hurricane, which is far more important.
Yeah, and kind of amazing, too, when you look at the devastation from that hurricane. All right. Well, it sounds like when it comes to Mother Nature, even when we're trying to protect extremely expensive aircraft, it's not always possible. And as you mentioned, David, there are higher priorities at times. So we may see this again, you know, with
I would change that verb. There's no may. We will see this again. Unfortunately, as far as military bases go, you want to go places, and especially training bases like Pensacola and all of the bases in Texas. You want to be able to train and Tyndall. You want to be able to train all year long. And there's a reason why those bases are there. The weather's good.
Ah.
All year long.
Most of the time. Except in, yeah.
Well.
But yeah, no, I get your point. That, you know.
I mean, it's, there's a reason why we've done what we've done. They're some of the oldest bases, you know. You don't learn to fly in Chicago. And this goes for, not that we have a lot of hurricanes on the West Coast, but here's something probably don't realize, but Miramar, Marine Corps Air Station Miramar, I think is only maybe 20 miles away from the San Andreas Fault. Lemoore is almost on the San Andreas Fault. Mother Nature will always win.
Yeah. All right. Well, sometimes you can grab control of the situation yourself. Now, if you're fighting Mother Nature, maybe not so much. But moving to another AvWeb story, this is passenger grabs controls after pilot collapses. Now, Max T, sometimes I think probably, you know, people, pilots maybe daydream about what happens in that time where somehow the pilot is incapacitated and you get to jump up to the cockpit and save the day. This is sort of a variation of that story, but it's a little bit different, isn't it?
You're right on all points there. Yes, I think pilots often think, gosh, maybe I'll be the hero and, you know, save the situation on the airliner, when we discover that both pilots had the chicken. they're going to need some help up there. What's really unusual about this story was that the passenger who helped save things was not a pilot. And she was in a helicopter. You think of helicopters being pretty, you know, helicopters are inherently unstable. You know, if you kind of let go of the controls for more than a couple seconds, yeah, you're going to have an unusual attitude. In this particular case, it was a tour which was going on in Hawaii in a Robinson R-44. And this couple had just gotten engaged, and part of the celebration was to, you know, go for this flight over Oahu shortly after getting engaged. The bride to be was in the front, her fiance was in the back, and apparently the 57-year-old pilot temporarily blacked out, had some type of a medical issue, and it became apparent that he was not in control of the aircraft. And I think in a separate story I read, not this one, that, you know, the lady initially thought, oh, maybe he's, you know, joking or kidding about, you know, being unresponsive. And yes, there are some people that might make that kind of a joke. I think scaring passengers purposely with those kinds of things is just, you know,
yeah, bad
just,
joke.
Just terrible. Absolutely, you know, unspeakable. Please don't do that to your passengers. It's not funny, and they probably will never fly with you again. But this was actually apparently some type of medical issue. They don't tell us exactly what it was. And as the aircraft apparently started to pitch forward and dive for the water, the fiance in the back said to, you know, pull back, pull back. So she grabbed forward on the cyclic. And so if indeed it was pitching forward, pulling back on the cyclic would indeed you know, get it more toward a level attitude. Now, they say it hit the water pretty hard and there were injuries, but everybody survived. My guess is that if you know, he had passed out, then he'd also let go of the collective. And so, you know, most of the upward force was gone. So all they really did was kind of get the pitch of the aircraft right before it hit. They weren't able to, you know, perhaps arrest the downward descent as much as if they'd been able to pull on the collective, the throttle. And the R-44 is also on the collective, and that had probably rolled down. So they were probably, with a very little power as they were coming down. But yeah, I would say it's quite credible that she may have saved their lives by pulling back on the cyclic, just in time. So it's a remarkable story.
Yeah, it really is. When I saw the headline, I assumed that this was, an airplane. And when I quickly learned that this was a helicopter, I thought, wow, how do you, who knows how to fly a helicopter besides a helicopter pilot? Not too many others. Now, obviously, as you said, she didn't fly the helicopter, but it does seem like she was able to pull back the stick in a way that softened the blow maybe a little bit. So she ought to be feeling pretty good. All three of them, I guess the pilot, there's a lot of detail on just really what happened to the pilot, other than this was some kind of a medical issue, but sounds like it was maybe temporary. But the FAA and the NTSB are investigating, and so we'll hear more about it from them.
And for helicopter pilots who are listening and heard me say cyclic, yeah, I did mispronounce it cyclic, I believe. So I think I said it both ways. But, I've had a lesson in a helicopter. I'm somewhat familiar with them. But oops, yeah, I did mispronounce that control there.
You did have one lesson, huh? Was that in a Robinson?
It was, as a matter of fact. Yeah, it was an R-22 years ago at the Lantana Airport, which has been in the news because of all the TFRs that are associated with presidential visits to Florida. And I spent, I think it was 1.3 hours tooling around in that thing, and holy cow, it was fun. It was not just a discovery flight. I said, give me the real first lesson. So we spent time on the ground hovering. We spent time, in flight. The flight portion, relatively easy by comparison. The hovering, and we had at least a 10, 12 knot wind at that time. Wow, that was really challenging to try and keep the aircraft in one spot with that kind of wind.
Yeah, the R-44, that was my one trip ever in a helicopter, which was amazing. I was in the back seat, and that was just a spectacular way to spend part of the afternoon. Well, another water landing that didn't work out so well from Australian Aviation, Lion Air Boeing 737 MAX 8 crashes in Java Sea. Now, Lion Air, of course, is an Indonesian low-cost airline flying this really brand new, I think as in delivered August, I think, of this year, 737 MAX 8. Took off from Jakarta, crashed into the sea 13 minutes later. All of the passengers and crew aboard are missing and presumed dead. They have, as we record this, found the site. But, you look at the flight radar 24 plot, shows that they reach an altitude of about 5,500 feet. And then there was a rapid descent and off the radar.
Yeah, and somewhat inexplicable as well. You would think by that time they would have the autopilot on, everything would be going well. Now, granted, they were probably out, they were over the sea, and I think it was at night, in which case, you might get some type of disorientation over the water. But I wouldn't expect that from an airline pilot flying a capable aircraft like this. So it is a little confounding that this airplane, crashed for no unknown reason. Now, the water is more shallow there. We've been searching for years for the lost Malaysia Airlines jet. This one, I think they're going to be able to recover simply because it's more shallow there. So we'll probably eventually get to the bottom of what happened with this particular aircraft.
And the fact that it had maintenance issues the day before.
Yeah. Which may or may not be related, so it's certainly possible.
Yeah.
What I was surprised to read was that in 2017, I'm not sure this was true, I read somewhere that there were no commercial airline accidents, no deaths anywhere in the world. And wow, if that's true, that's amazing. Because, I thought there had been some, but maybe not.
Now, Lion Air is kind of interesting. I think their first flight was in the year 2000, and they are actually the second largest customer of Boeing. They've got a lot of Boeing 737s, a lot of Boeing aircraft, a little over 100, mostly 737s. They do have a 747, and they do have a couple of Airbus A330s, but lots of new Boeings, and they have something like 500 more on order. So, they've been growing. They have had some problems in the past. If you look over some of the incidents, some of the accidents, many of them, well, maybe all of them, but non-fatal accidents, but some pretty serious accidents in that short period of time. Also, I think at one point they were banned from the EU, but I probably shouldn't, because I'm not sure. I think it might have been because of poor arrival performance as opposed to safety issues. But I did look before we recorded to see if there was something new on this. And the New York Times has got a little update on it. According to the New York Times, it says a spokesman for the country's air navigation authorities said the aircraft had requested permission to turn around several minutes after takeoff. So that's very interesting. But it is a developing story. And there is even a little bit of a conflict in some of the reports as to the number of passengers that were aboard. But it seems like 181, but it might be plus or minus one or two, depending on which report you look at. So very tragic. Of course, our hearts go out to the families of the victims and all those affected.
And I did a quick check, and 2017, there were no fatal jet aircraft commercial accidents. There were about 10 fatals that involved turboprops, cargo planes, things like that. And they contrasted that with 2016, in which they said there were actually 16 accidents among airliners. So that was statistically quite an anomaly to have 2017 go from 16 accidents to zero in 1 year.
Yeah, amazing. All right, what's up with the geeks? You know, this has sort of become the Max Trescott segment because you're doing all. So you went to another AOPA fly-in.
I did. I went to the fourth and final one this past weekend, which was in Gulf Shores, Alabama. And for folks who've never been there, it's a pretty cool part of the world. It's my third visit to Gulf Shores. First time was teaching about 10 years ago in Cessna 400 to aircraft. And the second time was refueling. We didn't actually leave the airport property. But I like that part of the world. It's really, really cool. In fact, there was a fire truck we saw at the airport. It said, Big Beach, Small Town. huge letters on the side of the fire truck. And I thought, that's very cool. And that really describes it. The beach runs for miles and miles and miles on this, thin strip of land. But there was a good crowd at the airport. I would say, from what I saw, probably the biggest attendance of all four of the regional fly-ins that were held this year. Weather turned out to be interesting in that on Thursday, the day before, it rained a couple of inches. But things were clear by Friday. Yeah, I was driving from New Orleans, where I flew into, and oh my gosh, at one point I was down to about 20 miles an hour on the interstate because the rain was so heavy that you really couldn't see very far ahead of you. So the weather worked out perfectly. It cleared just in time. Largest attendance I've had at any of the presentations that I've done. So I think it was a really good turnout all the way around. But then the fun part, the really, really fun special part for me was on the way home. I left a little bit early so I could spend some time touring the battleship USS Alabama and the submarine USS Drum. And I had never been on a battleship or a submarine before. I've toured two different aircraft carriers, and these were distinctly different and really very interesting. The thing I was struck by the submarine was just how small and narrow it was. Some of the passageways were, difficult for, a tall adult to get through and by. The contrast then touring the Alabama was, oh my gosh, this thing is huge. There was just space galore. Two very interesting contrast. And the interesting thing about the Alabama, apparently it's the only battleship in the world in which they've cut into the side of one of the 16-inch gun turrets so that you can walk inside. Otherwise, the only access would be a very tiny door at the bottom, which I guess none of the other battleships on display let you in through. So it's amazing to actually get inside that turret. And they have a lot of the 5 foot tall, 2,700 foot pound projectiles in there, which the Alabama could shoot nearly 21 miles away with good accuracy.
It's amazing.
So it's pretty phenomenal to be inside of one of these gun turrets and, see all that from a firsthand basis. So I would encourage anybody who makes it down to the Mobile, Alabama area, definitely check out, the battleship and submarine. They also had a lot of airplanes on display. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough time to stop and look, but they had an SR-71 Blackbird there. They had a B-52. Those were the two I noticed, and a lot of other things as well.
Okay, Mr. Trescott, here's your question.
Oh, no, I'm so screwed.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dave.
Let's see how well you know your submarine trivia.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
What was the USS Drum name? Who was the USS Drum named after?
I think I read that and I've forgotten it already. Go ahead.
The drumfish.
Oh.
What's a drumfish?
They make a drumming sound.
All U.S. submarines up until the fleet ballistic submarines and nukes were in World War II, they were all named after fish.
Hmm.
Swordfish, drumfish, mackerel. So if you go back and look at your submariner history, you'll note that they were all named after fish. And the USS Drum was named after the drumfish.
Ah. Hmm.
Which I read was one of several species which make a drumming sound, which was news to me. I had no idea that any fish did that.
Huh.
So there you go, Max. There's some trivia for you to share with all your friends. Oh, and by the way, Max, all three of the Missouri class battleships that are on display, all four, will let you go into the turrets.
Hmm.
Jersey, Missouri, Iowa, and I should know the last one. But Wisconsin. So all of those on display now, the Missouri being behind the Arizona in Hawaii, the Wisconsin in Norfolk, the New Jersey in Camden, and off the top of my head, I think the Iowa is in Los Angeles. Los Angeles. Okay.
It was up here for a long time. It was in the Naval Reserve fleet. I used to see it sitting there with all the other mothballed ships, but they towed it a couple of years ago down to Los Angeles to be a museum there.
So, folks, just so you know, I am, and Max, I'll use this to drum into my thing of the week.
Yeah.
In case anyone's looking, this historian here got let go from his job 2 weeks ago. So he's looking for a new position. Worlds of knowledge on marketing, history, etc. So if anybody has any leads or some advice, I'll be happy to take it. I'm looking for a new adventure, and I'd like to, at this point in my life, maybe do something I really like in the industries I really love. So with that, I'm just going to say, if you want to send me a note, send it to david@theuavdigest.com. And I already have had some real help from our UAV listeners. But again, I really would like to do something at this point in my life where I'm in an industry I love, and hopefully, unlike other podcasters, it won't make me leave podcasting. So we'll see.
All right, good. Well, we've certainly got a great network of listeners and friends, and maybe someone will have some ideas for you, David. That would work out really nicely. Now we've got a couple of recordings. Some from Brian and one from Micah. Both of them attended some events recently, different events. And we'll start off with Brian. Brian spoke with the representatives of the air show sponsors, FedEx and the Lion Air Museum. And he was at the Great Pacific Air Show. That was in Huntington Beach, California. Just recently, October 19th through 21st, 2018. And Brian also talked with a former guest, an aviation attorney, Ray Johnson, and also some very, very enthusiastic fans. But first, let's start with Mark Foster, who's president of Lion Air Museum.
Hi, this is Brian, and I'm here with Mark Foster, the president of Lion Air Museum. Mark, welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for having us, Brian. I really appreciate it.
Being a sponsor of the Huntington Beach Air Show, how'd that come about, and why is the museum a sponsor of the air show?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. A few years ago, before this show was even created, some friends of ours came to see us one day, and they said they had this idea for doing an air show at Huntington Beach, and we thought, wow, that's a great idea, but how are you going to pull it off? And so we told them, well, you know, we think it's a great idea. We'd be happy to be on board. Let us know what we can do. And so a little time went by, and they got in with the, you know, obviously the local government here and got everybody on board and started rounding up sponsors. And next thing we knew, you know, we were one of the major founding sponsors. And, you know, we brought our C-47 here for doing flybys.
Right.
And then we also we provide space on our flight line. So we do all the operations for the civilian acts.
Okay.
So all the airplanes that come in and perform in the show, or just about all of them, the exception of like the Thunderbirds, who are based out of Los Alamitos here, are on our ramp during the week.
And so, that's all at John Wayne Airport.
It's all at John Wayne Airport. And the neat thing is, you know, when we built the museum at John Wayne Airport in 2008, you know, I knew right away, having come from a place where we could do air shows right where the museum was located, being Chino.
Right.
You know, I thought, well, we're not going to do air shows here. It's John Wayne Airport. There's too many airliners flying in and out of here. And now all of a sudden we have an air show that's literally, you know, 3 minutes after you take off, you're in the performance box, you know, the performer's box right over here off the beach. So it's worked out really, really well to be able to, you know, have this show and it kind of be our own show.
Right, and are there any challenges being at the beach versus a traditional air show at an airport?
The markers, obviously, and the aerobatic box, I think, you know, they got floating markers instead of stationary markers on runways and things like that. But, I think the crowds, you know, obviously the crowds are, you know, a bigger deal because it's harder to get, you know, it's one beach, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And you'll notice the difference between this show. If you were a diehard person who had to see airplanes flying every single second at an air show, then when you're at an airport, you can see them take off and land.
Right.
You don't get to see them take off and land. If everything goes correctly, you don't see them take off and land here, other than some of the search and rescue stuff and the paratroopers, you know, the parachutes coming in. You're standing with your feet in the sand. It's a beautiful day. You got the ocean right there. So nobody cares if the airplanes are taking off and landing in front of you, just to see them perform and everything. It's the biggest party around. And I think this is probably one of the biggest outdoor gatherings of people in the history of the world.
Well, certainly at the beach.
Yeah, definitely.
Right?
It's a really big deal. So it's wonderful.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the museum and the collection that you have there?
Yeah. Well, so we built the museum at the end of 2008. We opened it up in 2009, and it was founded by General William Lyon, who was during World War II. He started off as a flight instructor, civilian flight instructor, training military pilots. Then he started ferrying airplanes all around the world, so he was delivering as part of the ferry command. And then was a combat pilot in Korea, and he flew C-46s and C-47s. And then he ultimately became chief of the Air Force Reserve, and that was from 75 to 79. Retired as a major general. And he's been a home builder in the area, William Lyon Homes. And so he wanted to make sure that the kids learned about the stories of the greatest generation. And so, you know, he started collecting, you know, he had an A-26 and a B-25, and then later DC-3s and C-47, and then also a B-17. And we had those at the airport. He thought, well, I got to make this be a place where kids can come in. So we got secured a lease on the airport that we could build a big building and get the museum started. And now, you know, what started to be, you know, it'd be tours on a case-by-case basis kind of thought turned into 7 days a week.
Yeah, and you definitely have an awesome facility there. So
yeah, it's a beautiful facility. And when you come to visit Lion Air Museum, a couple of things that stand out. One is it's all glass on both sides. So you look out through all these glass panes. I think there's like 270 glass windows or something, 260. Mm-hmm. Ask the cleaners. And and that's only on one side. That's just on the runway side. And then the parking lot side, there's another bunch of glass there. So it's really open and airy. The floors are painted white. So it really, you know, mm-hmm. Really puts the focus on the airplanes themselves, and because they're just in such a clean environment, and that's kind of a neat thing for us.
Anything new at the museum that you could talk about, or anything coming up?
Yeah, there's always something, you know, some new adventure, some new event we're doing, but we're getting really into on the educational side. We're already part of the Newport Mesa Unified School District sixth grade curriculum, and so we get the sixth graders coming in all throughout the year, and they meet our docents and so forth. But we just added an aviation for kids program, and so it's basically basically an introduction to teach kids, more of the STEM side instead of the history side.
Right.
And so we have a flight simulator, and the kids come in, they make gliders, and they get to build them on the spot and try them out in our hangar, and then they get to take them home, and so it's a pretty neat deal.
Is that FedEx
flying overhead? Yeah, I think that maybe FedEx or the Virgin Galactic thing or something. I don't know, but. But anyway, so that's good. And then we do these history on the flight line days a few times a year. We do open cockpit days for the airplanes.
Nice.
We even have, we have cars there as well, which is kind of funny because we're an air museum, mm-hmm. but we think there's a big crossover. And we'll do anything to spread the word about the Greatest Generation. So the idea is if we can get car guys to come in and see these really crazy, unique cars we have, and it gets them more interested in the airplanes or gets their kids more interested in the airplanes, and that's what we do. So we do car events, airplane events, motorcycle events, but it's all around Lion Air Museum.
And it's right there at the airport, which is great as well.
Yeah, very convenient. It's easy to get to. It's kind of hard to find, but easy to get to when you know where it is.
Right.
It is on the airport. Sometimes people think it's next to or somewhere, but it's actually on the airport, but it's on the west side midfield at John Wayne Airport. So it's basically across from the terminal building. You have to, go around, circumnavigate the airport and end up on the west side.
And the website for our listeners to find out more about the Lion Air Museum?
It's lionairmuseum.org, so lionairmuseum.org, and Lion is spelled with a Y, so it's L-Y-O-N Air Museum. And, nowadays, like Instagram and Facebook and all that, we're Lion Air Museum, so L-Y-O-N Air Museum, so you can really see day-to-day what's going on, Instagram, Facebook, and our website.
Great, Mark. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
All right, great. Next up, Brian talked with Tina Rogers from FedEx, who I guess they had a display, an aerial display.
Hi, this is Brian from the Airplane Geeks. I'm here with Tina Rogers of Federal Express. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
It's kind of unusual at an air show to have FedEx here. Why FedEx and why the Huntington Beach Air Show?
Well, it's actually not unusual for FedEx to participate in an air show because, as you know, we are an airline, very supportive of the aviation community. We have more than 600 airplanes in our fleet and over 4,000 pilots. So we are a member of the aviation community, and that's why we support it.
Okay, no, that's awesome. You just wouldn't think air show and FedEx, the aviation part, completely get.
Sure.
So, and are you based in Memphis?
I am. I'm based in Memphis. I work at the world headquarters in Memphis, Tennessee.
The weather here today is not such a bad part of the duty either, huh?
The weather here today is amazing. I'm absolutely thrilled. It couldn't have picked it better.
The 757 that's flying, is that part of your mainline fleet? You've just taken it out of service for this air show?
We absolutely did, yeah. We had to look at our operation to figure out where we wanted to fly out of, so they're actually flying in and out of San Diego each day.
Really?
So our crew members are staying in Huntington Beach, drive to San Diego after the briefing, fly over, fly back, and then drive back in the mornings for the briefing. So solely based on operational necessity and what we can spare for the air show.
And then how do you coordinate timing for the performance that they're going to do? If they're leaving from San Diego, that must take a bit of coordination.
Yeah, it does. We actually have calls usually once every 2 weeks for about a month and a half prior to the air show with the air bosses here and with our crew members in Memphis, our maintenance operations control center, and our GOCC center. So we all have a coordination team that has conversations bi-weekly to coordinate the schedule and how we're going to arrange, in addition to what direction we're going to fly our airplane over the air shows.
Right, okay. One of the things that people have been talking about for a while now is the shortage of airline pilots. At FedEx, are you experiencing that as well? And if so, what are you doing to combat that?
With any airline, when you have pilots that started a company when it's brand new and it's 45 years old, there's some attrition in the middle of that. So
Right. We've
got a couple of programs that we are working on. One of them is called Purple Wings, where we're doing pilot recruitment all over the country. One of the places that we did it recently was at EAA, which is the largest air show in the country. So we definitely have a plan in place to replace some of the pilots that might be leaving with new ones that we want to bring in.
Awesome, that's great. And as far as performance today, what can we expect to see?
You'll see a little bit of a slow pass at first, and then you'll see a little bit of a faster one, and he'll wave as he flies over FedEx. Not everybody's familiar with the wave of a larger aircraft, but it's where they kind of go side by side, and just kind of tell you hello that they're coming by and they see you downstairs.
A little bit more of a tilt than it is.
It's a tilt. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I was here last year and saw the flyby. So similar to that.
It's similar, but they've done a little bit of movement over the air show. Last year they were a little farther away, so you'll find that it's a little bit closer to our chalet. So you just get a better visual because it's a little bit closer to our tents than it was last year.
Great. People looking for more information or FedEx or to join the airline, where should they go for more information?
Well, we've got a career website. It's fedex.com/careers. So that's the easiest way to get information on what's available all over the country. We hire all the time in all positions, not just for pilots, but in our operations, courier positions and handler positions. So we're actually in the middle of our busiest season of the year right now. So it's a good time to look into jobs at FedEx if somebody's interested.
You know, you have a fairly large facility at LAX.
We do.
Are the flight crews based out of LAX, or is everyone in Memphis, or how?
Flight crews are based all over the place.
Okay.
They have certain bases. Everybody flies in and out of Memphis, in and out of Indy. We've got many hubs in other places outside of just Memphis. So the majority of our pilots are based out of Memphis, even if they don't live there. But you can also be based out of our other hubs and other locations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Really
Thank you. So nice
time.
To meet you.
All right. Next. Brian spoke with Ray Johnson, a previous Airplane Geeks guest.
Here I am at the Huntington Beach Air Show, and I come across Ray Johnson, former guest of the Airplane Geeks. Ray, welcome back to the show.
Well, welcome. How did you like this one? Pretty good show.
It was so great running into you at the tent. You had your table all set up, so you've apparently gone from the beach to a tent to the major sponsored tent. Well done.
Well, this year they have this. It's new and it helps support the whole show. And since Breitling pulled out, which was not happy for me, but Breitling pulled out, they have to get sponsorship some other way. And hopefully more and more Californians will decide to do that.
And your Air Force Thunderbirds were here at the show. What do you think of them this year?
They were, and I love them. And, you know, it just brings back memories from my own flying days, and that's kind of fun, too. That's cream on the cake.
Besides the Thunderbirds, what other performers did you find interesting at this year's show?
Well, I didn't get his name, but the very last stunt plane, it was a biplane. I thought he was just terrific. They said he had a grandfather with 5 grandchildren. I don't care if he is or isn't. He knows how to fly. He was just terrific.
Yeah, I'll have to look through the show notes and find out who that was, but that was definitely an impressive performance. Yeah. And then there was the special yak that was flying. What do you think of that?
Well, that was a little hard to take at first. I literally, when I first saw it, I did not know it was coming. And I looked, and it looked to me like someone had put 2 airplanes together and was flying it around. And sure enough, someone put 2 airplanes together and was flying it around. I was impressed that he could do so many high G maneuvers with something like that. That was very impressive.
Yeah, without it falling apart.
Right, yeah, like when he's coming out of the loop and things like that. My love is with the Thunderbirds and the F-16s. That's my first love anyway.
And just refresh our listeners' memory. What did you fly in the Air Force?
Well, I had the pleasure. My first year in the Air Force, I was over in Vietnam, and I flew forward air control type things. And then after that, I was instructor pilot in T-37 primary jet. Then I went on to be a maintenance test flight pilot in both the T-38, which is the trainer version of the F-5, and the T-37 at the same time. And finally, I got a chance to fly the F-15 before separating, and that was kind of fun. I like that.
With your law practice that specializes in aviation, or one of the areas that you specialize in, any interesting cases that you might be able to talk about? Or?
Well, we just concluded one, but unfortunately, the manufacturer involved put a a big confidentiality protective order on it. So yeah, it's a little so hard for me to say
it.
Almost
right.
Nothing can I. Just 2 years of my life, a little tough. But it went really well for my clients. So that was what was important.
So then, in general, what type of aviation law do you practice?
Well,
if there's a typical client, what do they do?
Generally, I'm representing a good number of the time pilots who are in crashes where they're blamed for the crash, and we find out that in fact it's some type of defect in the airplane or maintenance problem with the airplane. That's typically what I do, and it's my specialty, if there I guess one could say, is actually military aircraft crashes around the world. And we've done cases involving F-15, KC-135, F-105, and others.
Okay, great. And if someone wanted to get in contact with you, if they had a legal issue, where would they find you?
Well, probably my website's the best, which is RPJ, which is my initials, Raymond Paul Johnson, RPJ Law, L-A-W. And then Corp is C-O-R-P for corporation. And so it's rpjlawcorp.com.
Great. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was great seeing you again this year at the Huntington Beach Air Show.
Well, thank you, Brian. We'll see you next time.
All right. And that was episode 434, I believe, where Ray Johnson was our guest. So you can learn more about what he does there. And then finally, Brian ran across a couple of very enthusiastic visitors to the show.
Hi, so Brian, for the final interview at the Honey Beach Air Show, I am with Jessica and Van. Hey, guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
As I was standing here watching the show with you, your unbridled joy over watching the Thunderbirds fly, can you possibly explain what you were feeling watching the demonstration team in the air?
It was like giddiness, just being a child again and being excited about something that I've loved forever.
There's nothing like it. Yeah. You know, no other feeling, that heart-pumping feeling of them flying over.
Was it the noise? Was it the precision? What was it about the show that did it for you?
For me, the noise. I love it. You know?
For me, I think it's the skill, the expertise that it takes to get to that point where you can fly so close to another plane and not have any kind of worry and with the kind of expertise, like you mentioned, like just precision of execution. It's amazing to me.
This has inspired you to become a pilot?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my dad used to be a pilot, so I've always been interested, but this, I told him even before we came, I was like, this isn't going to help with my wanting to become a pilot.
Is he in the military or commercial, or what type of pilot was your dad?
My father was, he was a private pilot.
Okay.
Before he became a quadriplegic, and so he actually had a couple of flights before he became a quadriplegic, and he's been pushing me to become one as well.
And still, looking at him, the joy on his face as all the demonstrations were going on, that was
so
special.
It's so cool. He loves it, and I think he's passed it on to me. You can tell, like, just even the amount of people here, the joy that this kind of stuff brings is, it's innate.
It brings up a question to me, because a few years ago, when the government was going through a financial issue and sequestration, and they stopped doing these performances, I think that was a mistake. I think I could speak for you and say that clearly that was a mistake as well, because it inspires people, right, to get into the field of aviation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't speak to what was going on in the government and where the funding was going and things like that, of course. But that being said, I do completely agree with you in the fact that if you take away the joy and the exposure to younger people, I mean, I'm not calling myself young, but...
But you are.
But, you know, I feel like that is definitely a travesty. You know, you definitely need exposure to understand the skill.
And how many kids are here on the beach, right? And if 10 of them are inspired to choose this as a career.
Right? Absolutely.
I think it's worth it.
I think it's a world, too, I think it's a world that you don't know until you're exposed to. You know, there's so many abilities of like other professions to just watch on TV and stuff like that, but if you're not there to witness it, you're missing out.
Right. Amazing. I want to see it again. Yeah. One more time.
Yeah, too bad today's the last day, right?
I know.
So it's over. All right, well, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Your time and being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Boy, that's great. There you have it right there, why one reason why air shows are so important. Okay, before we get to Micah's report, we do have a positive airline story of the week. Who's got this one?
Max here. I just saw this on Twitter a couple of moments ago, and it comes from a former guest of ours, Jennifer, who works for Jennifer. That's her handle on the Twitter. She works for a large commercial airport in the Midwest, and she just posted this on Twitter. She wrote, "A passenger accidentally took her husband's keys with her to Fort Myers. Rather than leaving her to deal with the problem on her own, Southwest Airlines flew them back on the next flight." Nice. I thought that's a great story. Now, I reposted that story, and I added a comment to it, and I said, "Southwest Airlines saves a marriage."
Oh, excellent. That's a nice one. All right. Well, now let's listen to Micah. He attended the EAA Chapter 141 Stick and Rudder, actually it's Rudda, RUDDA, Fall Fly-In and Poker Run. And so here's Micah.
After attending EAA Chapter 141's annual Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In in July, I was truly looking forward to their Stick and Rudder Fall Fly-In and Poker Run in early October. Local helicopter pilot and regular Airplane Geeks listener Ernie Eaton invited me to fly with him to the event at the Lymington Harmon Airport from Sanford, Maine. For those of you following along on your charts at home, that's a flight from SFM, Sierra Foxtrot Mike, to 63 Bravo. While it's actually a longer drive for me to Sanford than it would be to drive directly to Lymington, Maine, the chance to visit with Ernie and another opportunity to fly in a Robinson R-44 helicopter was well worth the extra few miles. I was going to be in the back seat of the R-44 this time, as Ernie had a co-pilot. That was fine with me, as it would give me an opportunity to experience this flying machine from a new perspective. At the beginning of the week, the weather looked like it was going to be fine, and we arranged to meet at the helicopter hangar at SFM at 0800. Weather changes, though, and by Friday night before the fly-in, we thought the event might be canceled, but chose to hold any decisions until early Saturday morning. That morning, at about 06:45, Ernie made the call. The weather was just too unsettled to fly. Ernie chose not to attend, and I decided to drive up to Lymington anyway and see what was going on. Upon arrival at chapter headquarters, I was welcomed by name by Ron Edson, the event organizer. We hadn't met before, but we'd been in touch via email. He must have recognized me from the Spurwink photos posted in show notes on episode 516 and 519. We talked a bit about the choice to go on or cancel the event. The radar sure looked like the weather was going to clear. And you know, once you make a logical decision based on the facts at hand, you can't second-guess yourself due to outcomes. Ron made the right call on the fly-in. And so did Ernie. Although the fly-in wasn't canceled, it was a cold gray day with a ceiling of around 4,000 feet. About half a dozen planes flew in. Bunk Chase was among those that did. He's one of the co-founders of EAA Chapter 141, and we spoke with him on episode 519. Bunk flew his beautiful yellow carbon cub to the event. He certainly has aviation in his blood. You see, Bunk lives on the other side of the field from the chapter hangar and keeps his cub hangared by his house. He said he wasn't going to come to the fly-in on the ground, so he got in his plane on one side of the airport, took off, flew the pattern, landed, taxied to EAA 141 chapter headquarters, and shut down. Now that's the spirit, and that spirit pervaded the entire event. You may remember my interview with Tim Bickford, who fully restored a gorgeous 1928 Travel Air 4000. He was there too, but kept his open cockpit biplane in the hangar, just across from chapter headquarters. The Travel Air looked sad, though. You could see she longed for the sky. A light drizzle started around 0900 or so, and the poker run for later in the morning was canceled. It was a bit disappointing, but it wasn't sad at all. You see, even with the rain and cold, there was a warm camaraderie among all attendees. There was still a great breakfast with coffee, eggs, pancakes, sausage, and of course all the wonderful hangar talk that goes along with any fly-in. Topics included emotional support squirrels, local flying clubs, and a newly purchased Cessna 180. Thanks to Launchpad, Hillel, and Max T, I was even able to hold my own when the conversation turned to ADS-B, both in and out. On a personal level, I made some new friends and may go flying with them sometime soon. And there's now an Airplane Geeks refrigerator magnet on the chapter fridge. So while cold and rainy is not the best weather in which to hold a fly in, you know what? It's not a bad time for one either. Still, I'm already looking forward to the next big EAA Chapter 141 fly-in. That'll be at the Spurwink Farm Grass Strip in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, in July 2019. If you're going to be in and around southern Maine around that time, mark your calendars for Bastille Day. That's 14 July for those who aren't sure. I hope to see you then. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Thanks, Micah. Boy, you gotta love someone who takes off from an airport, flies the pattern, lands at the same airport, and goes to the event at the airport. I think that's just really cool.
Yeah, and of course, I always hear, anytime somebody talks about an emotional support animal that's a squirrel, I think, yes, but it's a flying squirrel, so, you know, it should be permitted. No, I'm kidding. You don't want any rodents on airplanes.
Yeah. Micah mentioned refrigerator magnets. I actually have a few Airplane Geeks, magnets. They're small. They're about like business card size magnets. So I may regret this, but if you'd like one, write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Send your mailing address, and while supplies last, as they say. I'll try to get some out. I may regret offering that up, but we'll do that. Okay, that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. If you want to contact us by email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Of course, we have show notes for every episode at airplanegeeks.com. Those for this specific episode you can get to directly by visiting airplanegeeks.com/525. And let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Max Trescott, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at Aviation News Talk. You can find me on Facebook as Max Trescott. And of course, easiest way to find me, just go to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
And David Vanderhoof.
You can find me looking for jobs on the internet. But besides that, you can, of course, find me on Twitter, on Instagram, or on that show on Friday mornings with that guy I love, Max Flight. And, of course, you can always check in our Slack listener team by sending us a request to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll be happy to send you an invite to enjoy the conversation with all of our other geek listeners that hang out in our Slack team.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David says, at the UAVDigest.com, and also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his work at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.